Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, J.D. Bunkus, Blake Murphy, Justin Cuthbert this week. Rogers Hometown Hockey is going back on the road starting on March 21st, trade deadline day. And it's going to be from Lloyd Minster. And you know who's going to be there? It's back on the road is Ron McLean, host of Hockey Night in Canada and Rogers Hometown Hockey. Hey, Ron, how you doing, man?
Great. How are you, man?
I'm doing very, very well. I'm excited. Hitting the road again, you know? Things feeling a little bit more normal. That's a good sign.
Well, that's what we thought when Buffalo rolled into Scotiabank Arena the other night. Great to have a capacity crowd and the spirit and the joy. Because apparently the night before at the Raptors, it was all that. But, yeah, it wasn't on Wednesday.
Yeah, well, here's the thing, though, Ron. That actually did feel like the normal thing. Kind of a crappy Leafs crowd, losing a Buffalo. I felt like a Leafs fan again, you know? Disappointment when there was an optimism. That was very familiar. That was pre-pandemic as it gets.
Right, and the sun is shining, and I should say I am overjoyed to get back out to Lloyd Minster. Actually, it's been a great venue for both Rogers Hometown Hockey and Scotiabank Hockey Day in the past. Good buddy in Chuck Wagon Racing, Kurt Benzmiller from just down the road in Dewberry. When I first started my broadcasting career, I did the color and hosted the Red Deer Rustler Junior Games with Frank Ryan, and he lives out in Lloyd Minster, so still going strong. It'd be great to see a whole bunch of friends there. But yeah. You know, as far as Wednesday night goes, it was it's just another one of those big stage nights that Toronto's got to get through somehow, some way going forward.
Okay, so let's actually just start with that. Do you believe that there is a flaw with this group? Because I can't tell if it's just anxiety of people, if it's bad luck, if it's the division, if it's one thing or another. And I keep coming back to feeling as though anytime they lose, that is the way the coverage goes, is, hey, they lost this game because there's a deep flaw. They don't get to lose hiccup games like other teams do. And part of that is because they play in Toronto, but I feel like there's something greater to it.
Yeah, it does feel like a sort of Damocles hangs over them whenever the lights get really bright. The playoff losses speak for themselves. I've often, and we all have, pointed to the David Ayers night as a moment when suddenly everybody's focused on you and what are you going to do about it? And it didn't go so well. And I felt like early in the year, the Pittsburgh game was a bit of a moment where a depleted Pens lineup to lose that badly. Now, having said that, I remember that night Matthews hit the crossbar and Muzzin hit the crossbar when the game was tight and the 3-1, 4-1 goals both went off defensemen. Liljegren in the first case and then Muzzin put one in off his skates. So it did feel like a lot of crazy things happened that particular night, but they chased Jack Campbell and they were in a bit of a free fall there. Then they went through that series of squandering 3-1 leads, and another big stage moment arrived where Matthews was on a tear, and they go into Madison Square Garden, New York, bright lights, and they get the lead, and they blow that one, and that's when Sheldon Keefe uttered the just soft and purposeless. But it was a big stage moment. Same with Rogers Hometown Hockey. We had Marty St. Louis, Montreal Canadiens hosting Toronto, and it's a big stage, and you know, it's 5-0 before you can blink, and Josh Anderson just runs roughshod, and then the full capacity game. So these are all, you know, and I look at Sheldon Keefe through the years. He seems to always try to give the biggest stars that bright light. In the Columbus series, he loaded up the big three, Tavares, Marner, and Matthews, on a line together. He was activating Morgan Riley. He put Sandin with Riley the other night, and every time he tries to give his big guns the opportunity, it hasn't seemed to pan out. But I will say that's, you know, you want to prep for what's coming down the pike by doing these things. You give everybody a role, like as weird as it looked to see Sandin with Riley, it didn't seem to make any sense. But I remember back to my Red Deer days, we had a great coach handled the AAA U18 squad, who would win countless national championships, and he always put everybody in different roles all the way till almost Valentine's Day, his theory being someone's going to get hurt to come playoffs. I don't want a guy playing in that situation for the first time in the playoffs. So maybe this is all a precursor to a plan, but we're waiting very patiently.
Yeah, that's the fear that people have, right, is that flaw of pressure is what cracks these guys, that it isn't that you got out goalied or it isn't that you suffered an injury at a wrong time. It's that these guys do feel that pressure and that this market, it matters more than anywhere else. It's funny that you mentioned the Montreal game because, you know, they have that awful first period and it comes back to you guys. And you, obviously, Hometown Hockey has these incredible stories and you guys run these features that everybody works so hard on. And all I was thinking is like, not now, Ron. Ron, you media, rip the team, say something bad about the league. Don't just run a story about a nice thing in this town. Everybody's mad and needs someone to hold them accountable. I always wonder how it feels whenever you do come off of like a highly emotional period like that, and then you have to throw to one of those things.
Well, I kind of, again, I'll give you, this will be my last Red Deer reference, I promise, but that's where all the Sutter boys played their junior hockey. And Brian Sutter was the first to say, you know, everything else is noise. Just watch the game. So you need a, you know, there's a lot of hockey on TV, and we've kind of positioned ourselves, as you know, as that feel good. Ironically, that night we had a feature, not in the first intermission, it was in the second, but we did have a feature on Josh Anderson's parents running the Turtle Jacks in Waterdown, Ontario, just outside Burlington. And it couldn't have been more apropos. I mean, he was tearing it up that night, and to get to know the family. If you were a Habs fan, it was actually serendipitous. But I agree with you. There are nights when, and as we go down the stretch here, you mentioned when we're in Lloyd, it's trade deadline day. So undoubtedly we'll have either Elliot or Jeff or someone helping us out to kind of keep track of what happened late on into the day. And then the games get so important, you know, that you do pine for a little bit of analysis. We were lucky this past weekend to have Adam Oates was incredible breaking down the two games. And that's one of the, even on Saturday nights, I find it complicated. But that night we had a Canucks critical game in New Jersey. The marquee game was, of course, Ovechkin and Washington against Toronto. But we also had to deal with Vancouver. You know, that was a bubble game where it just felt like, could all be riding on this 1-2 points, and didn't go well that night. And thankfully, we did have Adam Oates to sort of address that.
Yeah, Oates was terrific. That was actually really, really great. I also thought the look of like a guy who breaks down film with the particular glasses he was wearing, I was like, this is a great look for you. As an image consultant for Adam Oates, I thought this is bang on. Way to sell the brand, Adam. I believe you. I'm on top of it. Hockey Hall of Fame, all of it. It worked.
He's got me now watching how guys go back and retrieve pucks, you know, even Jack Hughes scoring and putting himself into the contact with Tyler Myers. It was just a really great breakdown of what can happen.
Yeah, he's phenomenal. So I guess I just have one more thing on the coverage for you. And this is something that I've been thinking a lot lately about with this team, obviously, right? Which is trying to find the truth, trying to find what actually is real. And we had Sundin on the show a couple weeks ago, and I think it started with this, which was I was thinking about how there were just more people watching Leafs games when Sundin played, right? It wasn't as competitive of a, I would say, media market. More people had cable. More people are tuning into these games. It felt like Leafs wins and losses mattered a little bit more in a regular season. Certainly, they were just a team that had been more recent to playoff success. I don't know. Now we have social media. So it's different in terms of the way a team is covered. It probably feels like it follows you around a little bit more differently as a player. But where do you look at this team in terms of how they're covered right now? Like, because of that roller coaster ride, that roller coaster element of when they win games, we're talking about them as being contenders. When they lose games, we talk about them being deeply flawed. Is there a way that you can kind of place them historically in terms of the nature of this?
Well, I will say, you know, to give you an example, obviously when you're thinking, how's Jack Campbell? How's his mental state right now? I go back to years ago, my boyhood hero was Jacques Plante, and he had won 3 straight Vezina trophies, and in his 4th year, the Montreal Canadiens are going for their 4th Stanley Cup, and he's kind of having a meltdown. I'll read you, actually, there's a book on Jacques Plante. I'll just read you a little section here. The mighty Montreal Canadiens in town for tonight's game with the Leafs have a host of problems. Worse than Plante's nervousness, a frustrated Toll Blake told the Star, so this is media coverage back in the 1950s, our home fans have been riding him and he's let it get his goat. It's affecting his work. He's been playing much better on the road because of this. He's got to get over it. After all, he's a professional. It isn't anything new. They've been at him a bit for years now. It's gotten worse since he was caught out of his net and Chicago scored on the empty net. You bet it's serious. Anytime there's something wrong with your goaltending, it's serious. Even the Canadians can't win a championship with bad goaltending. So that's a newspaper account of Jacques Plante's collapse that year. And, you know, playing goal in Montreal, Plante followed a legend, Bill Dernan, who walked out of the rink after the 3rd game of a series against the New York Rangers and gave it up. He retired because he was, you know, finding it too tough. And the guy that replaced him was Jerry McNeil in Montreal, and he had ulcers in the left. And then Jacques Plante was suffering this breakdown in his 4th season. We all know Ken Dryden left after 8 seasons in the NHL, Hall of Fame, you know, greatest goalie, and just walked away. Patrick Roy stormed out of Montreal. Carey Price says he's found himself in a dark place. I don't know if it's game related or anything, but you know, the pressure of playing net in these markets, I don't think it has changed. Even though you're right, there's a multitude of ways it comes at you. Those names I just gave you, dating back to all the way back to Bill Dernan, lets you know how hard it is to play goal.
Yeah, I see. I'm glad that you had that reference and that you were able to share that with us, because when I think about this stuff, I go, yes, social media is hard in the sense of you have to have the power within yourself to shut it off. Your phone's at your disposal. It's actually linked up to your brain in a way that, you know, we actually realize is addictive to us now. So it's different. Mm-hmm. It's also a part of, you know, younger person's culture where, yeah, you're just used to being bored and you go on some of these apps. But you referenced that newspaper article and I go, I feel like more people would have read that in Montreal than anybody's reading a tweet.
Well, Dryden said in his book, The Game, he said, yeah, I would go to the dry cleaners, I would go to the corner grocer, and, you know, they knew. They looked at you in a way that said, Ken was awful last night.
Yeah.
And he you know, and you know, professional pride. I mean, look, I kind of maintain it's there is that addictive quality that I despise. There is that narcissistic element that I despise. But there's the, you know, accountability that it provides that I do admire about social media. You know, it tunes me in every third week in some way, because, you know, back to, you know, our business is trying to code switch to the sensibilities and the sensitivities of, you know, could be as many as 5 million viewers in a Stanley Cup playoff game. So you're never going to please everybody, but you should at least be made more aware of other points of view. And that's been the one good thing. And then after that, you know, all the, you know, Plante had to get through it. Terry Sawchuk had to get through it. All kinds of great, you know, Grant Fuhr got sent down to the Moncton Alpines in his second year. Tom Barrasso got demoted to Rochester after winning the Calder Trophy. I just think, you know, I was a goalie as a kid, and I gave it up because I just couldn't take it. You know, I just decided I like playing defense more than I like playing goal. It's just easier. And it's a tough row to hoe, and I admire those who do it. Kelly Rudy, of course, we're lucky to have on the panel as a guy who went to Tony Robbins when he was melting down in 1993 and just needed something to kind of, and Robbins' advice was, you know, look at Schwarzenegger. And actually, I didn't mention Plante, he would never take responsibility for a goal against. He didn't blame necessarily, but he would try to explain what happened out front of him, because he had seen Dernan, you know, could not handle it, took it all on himself, the way Jack Campbell seems to. And Plante became considered, you know, a bit standoffish or a bit solitary in his approach. But I think it was his coping method.
Ron, a goaltender that's not facing any trepidation when entering the supermarket right now is Jacob Markstrom with the Calgary Flames. I know these situations are different. The Flames team in 04 was a bit plucky, more of an underdog. But these Calgary Flames look like they could have similar success when it comes to the postseason, being the Pacific Division leaders and playing really, really good hockey under Daryl Sutter right now. Is this shades of 04 or shades of maybe
sure
2010 or 2012 with the Los Angeles
Kings
right,
yeah,
right now?
You're right. It's shades of Red Deer Rustler that I mentioned, Daryl Sutter, for sure. You know, I see Richie hasn't scored a goal all year, and he plays and he plays. And Milan Lucic plays and he plays. And, you know, they are totally, because back in the day it was Christoph Oliva, you know, who I used to, my biggest kick was watching Oliva flip pucks into a bucket at the end of morning skates or practices on the off days. He actually had really nice hands, but he could also scare you. And that's, you know, Daryl always wants, you know, those big power forwards such as Dwight King and Jordan Nolan, he brought up immediately, and he had just big, hard, heavy hockey to play against, and he had the goaltending. He brought in Kiprusoff almost immediately. I remember they lost in Edmonton. Really tight game. They had dominated. It was either November or maybe late October. They had played up at Edmonton, the Flames, in 2003-04. And he said, I said to Daryl, had you had a save, you probably win that game. He says, don't worry, we're fixing that tomorrow. And the next day they got Kiprusoff from San Jose. So Markstrom for sure, and they brought in Tanev with Jacob, so tremendous leadership, right? And they do remind me entirely of what we experienced both in the Flames run and LA's run.
So back on the road with Rogers' hometown hockey beginning March 21st, I hope there's an opportunity for you guys to get on the road for the postseason. And you've been, you know, sort of navigating viewers in Canada through postseason hockey for as long as I can remember. And I wonder, you know, as I reflect and I sort of romanticize the Stanley Cup playoffs and all that goes into it, what your most memorable postseason was to cover in your career?
Well, I always point to the first, just because I had worked 2 years of covering the NHL without doing a playoff game, and then I went to Hockey Night in Canada in 1986-87. So the spring of 87 is the first one I work. And we're in St. Louis, and everything about it was magical. The weather was warm, and I always remember Mark Messier saying it's a lot easier to go to the rink in flip-flops on the off days. Your body just feels so much better, and you're in a good mood. So we go in on a sunny drive with Bob Cole to my right and Don Cherry and Harry Neal in the car, and we go into the old arena there in St. Louis, and they're playing When the Saints Come Marching In, and the Budweiser jingles, and it's Brophy's Boys, and the energy. I mean, it's hard to explain the energy of a great playoff series. And it was Blues Leafs, and there was two guys plastered up against the glass and bleeding 30 seconds in. And I thought, wow, 9 weeks of this. And that was just a tremendous joy to experience. And I do feel like in the rink is, you know, somehow we've had these situations where Canada was empty and U.S. had crowds, and you could see the difference. So it's going to be nice, and I do hope that we'll be able to. Well, we'll have to headquarter for the first few rounds, but for the final, it would be great to hit the road again.
It would be great, Ron. We really look forward to that and hope that happens. Thanks so much for taking the time this morning, man. Enjoy getting back on the road in a couple weeks. We look forward to it. Rogers Hometown Hockey. Ron McLean, thanks so much.
Much appreciated. Cheers, guys.
Ron McLean, Hockey Night in Canada, Rogers Hometown Hockey. They're back on the road March 21st in Lloydminster, Alberta. Not on the road are the Toronto Maple Leafs. And Leaf fans, we're giving away a pair of tickets to the March 8th game against Seattle. All you have to do is download Friday's episode of the Fan Morning Show, that's this episode, and listen for the different code words that will be placed into the podcast. Take that code word, text it to 590-590, and you'll be entered in for a chance to win. Each code word counts as an entry, and the winner for this game will be selected Monday. So that's Leafs Kraken on March 8th. Download the podcast episode, listen for the code word, and while you're doing that, rate, review, subscribe, all that good stuff.
Good karma. I love the idea of a person that's been listening to this entire show, and then they have to go back and listen to the podcast once it goes up, and then they also still lose the contest. It's just, you got to listen to 5 hours of this show today, all right? 5 hours and you get no reward. Too bad. Leave a review. Better be positive. I need to flesh this out. I really need to think this over, but I have like a kernel of an idea of a thing when it comes to pressure. And I've been trying to flesh it out. And it's like, it comes to me in a dream almost, you know? It's like I'm, you guys ever see, what's that McConaughey movie where there's different timelines and there's the dust and space?
Ghosts of Girlfriends Past?
No. Yes, exactly that one. No, Interstellar, where the bookshelf is moving, there's dust on the bookshelf, and he's like, how do I get this idea, or what is it trying to tell me? There's something that I'm trying to kind of put together about whether or not we think that people and athletes and teams are designed for pressure in the same way. Like, when I think about this Leafs team, and Ron tells stories about guys going to a dry cleaner and knowing that someone's disappointed in their play last night. Like, accountability being something that, with a hockey team or with a team, was like this community thing. That it was covered in a paper, that it was put on television. And now that it's kind of siloed off on all these things, they're easier to avoid. A player doesn't need to face as much criticism. The one place they'll kind of get it is social media. But social media isn't a place where there's criticism from someone who's either somewhat qualified, or where it's, if you see someone in person and you criticize them, it's going to be at least humane, right? It's a bad look at a place. Social media reads something and it's awful. It's someone will say something to you that is beyond reprehensible, and it'll be in a pile, right? It's not one person saying one thing. And I wonder if this is kind of making it more conducive to, when people are in high stress pressure situations as athletes, if it's actually something that's harder to achieve because you don't have those reps as much. Or it's just a little bit more difficult, even though weirdly it should be easier, because athletes have never been more sheltered. Like, They are. People talk about how difficult social media is, but in reality, it's such an easier media climate now compared to what it used to be if your team sucked.
And how easy has it been on the Maple Leafs, you know, the last couple of years? Like, my theory coming out of that bubble, the bubble playoff, where they're coming into a season where you'd never have to interact with a media member.
Exactly.
You'd live in this silo. Like, you could be completely separate from everything in the outside world. I thought it would really benefit this team. They could sort of get back to it, really bond as a group and grow with each other. Maybe we saw that in the postseason, but then again, when the world started to open up, everything started to become real again, and they hit the playoffs, they hit that adversity, and we get that same result. I just don't think you can compare, like, social media to reactions in the public space. Like,
it's
you
hard.
Might get a bad look.
No,
you might get a bad look, but you more likely get, like, just people noticing that you're there, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's got to be a weird experience, but it's not even close to what you would get on social media. Like, that's just opened up this new level. And getting Ron's thoughts on that and what it was like before was, you know, interesting insight.
Yeah, again, it's a kernel of an idea, and it's something that I really want to think about and reflect on more, because right now I'm doing the Michael Scott thing of I'm starting a sentence and I don't even really know where it's going to go or whatever. That's basically what's happening here. But yeah, think about even just if media members ask a tough question, it gets portrayed as, wow, look how awful that media member is for asking that tough question. That's the way that it gets perceived a lot of times by the public. You know when the only time you get to really press a team is? When they get knocked out of the postseason. That's when the Leafs get tough questions, right? And guess what happens? They get pissy. Think about how pissy Kyle Dubas has been at some of these things. Like, remember when they got knocked out and he started doing all the things about how Cody Ceci's numbers are way better and nobody understands Cody Ceci except for him? Yeah. And he just lost his mind on it? You went, whoa, what are you doing, man? He's better since, but that was awful. That was a terrible look. You lost to Columbus, and you're telling people that we're all dumb and Cody Ceci's good. Okay. Look at last year. Marner, the way that he took the media coverage of, hey, Mitch, you didn't score and you got essentially no points and you blew it against a crappy Habs team. Meltdown. Media meltdown. Only time where they get asked hard questions, could barely even comprehend that it was happening. Look at what happens when, I know it's not professional. I'm not saying that every media environment should be like Jim Matheson in Edmonton. That was obviously kind of a bad look and it was pretty Bush League and obviously it was a personal vendetta thing. But that's such an aberration now that someone would actually like challenge a player at a podium or ask a really difficult question. I'm just saying that these things are in balance. I think that a lot of times we sort of shape this narrative that athletes in the social media era have to deal with things that are so much different than athletes in the past, and that athletes in the past, they just had it easy. Nobody even really cared about the games. They were just going out there and playing and drop the puck, and then you go home and you're with the wife and kids. You go out to the bar. No big deal. No coverage. No phones. No nothing. And I actually think that there's a growing case, the more I'm watching this, that it's actually easier to be an athlete now. And because there aren't those pressures in the same way, because people don't hold you accountable the same way, because you do have a more insulated bubble, that, and then the only way to pierce it is through these incredibly harsh things on social media, that it creates this anxiety for failure and fear of those social media pylons, but also not like the rep building or the, I don't like saying character building because that's always so lame and it sounds like an old man thing, but yeah, that same kind of pressure rep that you would have gotten in the past. I don't know. Maybe this is a nothing take, but it feels like there's something.
It's just easier to not have an opinion right now. Like to just be as vanilla as possible, because if you're not, you open yourselves up. When 30, 35 years ago, you could have these conversations, you could be opinionated, you could take a stand for something, and you wouldn't have every single person in the world looking to quote tweet it immediately. I think really that's the difference.
You know who doesn't have vanilla takes and doesn't mind playing the heel? Ariel Helwani. Well, you too, JD, but this is we're going heel versus heel in the last block for this week.
We're trying to steal his thunder.
We're going to talk to Ariel Helwani about UFC 272 this weekend. I don't know. Maybe we'll tick him off. Maybe we'll tick him off out of the gate. We'll talk about his Knicks, too, before we sue him for his fake mixed martial arts guests. That's next on the Fan Morning Show.
I don't even believe he watches.
Who would at this point, right? Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590 The Fan. The code word for today's episode to text to 590-590 to qualify for your shot to win Leafs Seattle tickets on March 8th is Kraken.
The smartest takes on the biggest stories in sports. The Fan Drive Time with Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Fan Morning Show. Sports at 590 The Fan. Blake Murphy, Justin Cuthbert, and shockingly, given some of the songs you've heard, not me on the aux cord, J.D. Bunkus on the aux cord today. I would say seven bangers out of the eight spots, and the eighth is a mystery one. Vic never played it, so we don't even know what it was. So you'll have to go to the Spotify playlist, The Fan Morning Show, aux cord Fridays, to find out what that mystery song was. Not a mystery, is that our next guest is our favorite guest, Ariel Helwani, host of the MMA Hour and the Ariel Helwani Show. What's up, man? How are you?
Favorite guest? According to who?
According to me.
Favorites? I don't believe it for a second.
I've got the mic. JD took yesterday off, and I totally changed the power rankings for guests.
I was wondering why it felt so much better off the top here. It just felt friendlier. It felt warmer. And now it all makes sense. I don't believe for a second that I'm your favorite guest. I think I'm Danielle's favorite guest because he texts me so much, but definitely not JD's.
You're not my favorite guest.
Well, yeah. You guys brought Ryan out of retirement over there?
Yeah, that's right. We did. We brought him out. We said, hey.
Am I going real inside baseball here? No one knows what I'm talking about, right? I'm going real inside.
I mean, some people might know. Fabro was on the station for a while. People know who Fabro is, I think, to a certain degree. It's okay for you to go inside baseball.
That's the only baseball you'll be seeing in Toronto this season.
How much baseball we seen in Montreal this season?
Ever. Never.
Same as Toronto. Baby.
Remember when you thought that the Rays were going to become your team half the time and like, oh,
never
Montreal, we might get a thing.
Never
it's like, oh, we might get a little team and we get a little optimism and we got the big O and we got all those things. Nothing, never.
It was never a baseball town.
Never believed it. You know what actually is the best thing that ever happened to Montreal baseball is the lockout, because it gives you guys the false belief that you were going to win and that in some way you got screwed over. And it's like, it wasn't because none of us actually cared about the team or anything and none of us actually went and that we're all horrible fans. It's because of the baseball screwed us over. That's the only reason why. You guys were Mickey Mouse all along. You're Mickey Mouse now. And guess what? You'll never get a team again. So good reminder. Thank you for that. So let's head into...
First of all, this is my show.
We go to the thing I want to do.
Number one, it was Sportsnet 590 Zone Stephen Brunt who got my hopes up. That's number one.
Yeah.
Number two, I never believed that the Tampa thing was going to work. Number three, get your facts right, Mr. Sportscaster. It wasn't a lockout in 1994. It was a player's strike. So get it right, all right?
Strike,
there's a big
lockout,
difference between
whatever.
The two. If you'd like for me to explain it to you, I'd be happy to. And number three, go look at the attendance records back in 1994.
You front runners went one time. Way to go. You're like Oklahoma City Thunder fans. You steal a team, and then they show up. They're like, oh, we got Kevin Durant, James Harden, and Russell Westbrook. Wow, what good fans they have here. They showed up for the first year of their team. That's you, front runner fans who show up one time, and then you're like, we're the best. How come we can't get a team? Boo-hoo, boo-hoo. Anyways, on to the other things. So – We had Colby Covington on this week. We had Jorge Masvidal on this week.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, I know. It was a lot. Honest to God, these two guys, I feel like the promotion of it has been horrific. But I've noticed the promotion of it. And the point I was making earlier in the show is that when we see Israel Adesanya and Robert Whittaker, we don't see those guys all over every single major TV show, right? Like, yeah, they'll do yours, which is a big one, but that's an MMA show. I'm talking about the other ones, like when you see all of a sudden they're on First Take. They're doing things with Stephen A. Smith. They're yelling at each other in super awkward, cringeworthy ways where you can't really get anything out of it. It's just kind of jumbled and garbage and doesn't really work for a hardcore UFC fan. Maybe it attracts somebody who's on the outside. But the UFC and ESPN seem to be embracing more the kind of like tail end of the Conor McGregor thing, the thing that seems to be working for Jake Paul, and they really seem to want to push it with the Jorge Masvidal and Colby Covington fight. Do you think that this is kind of just the way that it's going to go? Because we've talked about how the UFC promotes its fighters and builds up its fighters, and it seems like right now this is the only playbook that they believe in, which is have guys say outlandish things. We can push the guys who are going to play it this way.
It's easy. It's low-hanging fruit. It's lazy. This is so easy. Let's put the two guys on there and have them yell at each other and have the host who's yelling at them too, and everyone will get excited about it. And there are people. Let's not pretend that there aren't people who get excited about this. I was watching the press conference yesterday, and at one point there was like 100,000 people on that stream on a Thursday night. So there's people who are interested in this sort of thing. But you'd love to see the same type of energy in terms of promotion to the likes of Alex Volkanovski, right? You have to have willing participants. These two guys, say what you will about them and how cringy the dynamic is, they are willing participants. They want to go out there and engage in this stuff. They want to promote. So it makes it easier. But yeah, I mean, I agree with you. There is a part of me that like just wants to fast forward the tape to Saturday night, get this fight over with, and we can, you know, move on with ourselves. Because honestly, the part that bothers, there's two things that really bother me about this fight. Number one, the fact that it's not happening in Miami is just absurd to me. It's like literally on 305 day. They keep talking about Miami and it's happening in Vegas. That's bizarre. Okay, fine. I could get over the fact that for some reason they didn't want to go to Miami. Number two, it's happening 2 years too late. This fight should have happened in 2019, 2020. And it reminds me a lot of the Tyron Woodley fight against Colby Covington, where it was a grudge match and it was a heated rivalry, but it felt like it was happening 2 years too late, and it feels like this one's happening 2 years too late. So I don't feel, once you get past the the beef, the feud, the trash talk, that there's a ton of intrigue in the fight, because I feel like a lot of people think they know how it's going to play out.
Yeah, I sometimes lose perspective on these things because maybe I'm too close to it in terms of what I care about from the UFC. But yeah, I just. Jorge Masvidal was talking to me about how he's in fear, or he wants to win this fight in part because he wants to show people this isn't the way that you do it, even though, like, again, that's like he's a willing participant in this type of promotion. He's actually doing a lot of the things that Colby's doing right now. Like, he came on and he was saying, oh, you know, you don't cross the line with things, but then he's also saying that, you know, Colby has gambling debts and he's got his mad herpes and doing all these things. I'm like, yeah, okay, well, you're sort of doing the exact same thing as he's doing, but maybe to a lesser degree. You're not involving people's wives. But yeah, you're right. There's a few things I don't like. I don't really think the matchup is all that intriguing. But yeah, it kind of gets to that core issue that I think you and I have both been bothered by for a little while, which is ever since the ESPN deal, it doesn't feel like they want to build fighters or promote fighters in the same way. They don't have the same capability of building stars because the Shield, the brand, wants to be the star more than anything else. Everybody kind of feels recyclable. And yeah, you end up with these fights where I go, why does this remind me so much of a Jake Paul fight? I thought the whole thing about the UFC was that it was supposed to be the best on best and that we were seeing, you know, a legitimate product. And this one doesn't feel that way to me.
Yeah, no, I'm not really going to disagree with that one. And also, historically, they don't put non-title fights at the top of the pay-per-view. This is the first one since 2015 that is a non-title main event that doesn't involve Conor McGregor or Nathan Diaz. That fight was Anderson Silva versus Nick Diaz. So they I think about how many pay-per-views they've done since 2015. So they very, very, very rarely do this. I like the pro wrestling stuff. I don't mind it. I don't get offended by it. I never really got offended by Colby, to be honest. When I used to work at ESPN, by the way, they used to ask me to ask him to take off the MAGA hat. They used to ask me to ask him if he can like sit in a certain way so that the Donald Trump picture behind him was not in the shot. Honest to God, and I never did, because I'm like, that's who he is. I get what he's trying to do. This is 90s WWF. I'm fine with it. I'm not offended by it. But you're sitting there, man, yesterday, and you're talking about like your ex-wife, wife, I don't know, kids. This is gross. This is gross. I don't want to hear this. I don't want to hear about herpes. I don't want to hear about alimony. I don't want to hear about any. This doesn't make me interested in a fight at all, especially when you're the kind of dude to do this stuff. You just did it. You just did this shtick with Kamar Usman, and then we caught you on camera saying it was all for show. Well, then, like, you just, I mean, like, the gimmick is no more. You just did this with Usman, right? You just went that route, talking about his dad, talking about him being in jail. and then you hugged them afterwards and said it was all for a show. That, it doesn't work like that. You would never see that in pro wrestling, right? You would see that behind the stage, you know, like in the gorilla position. We wouldn't be privy to that, but you wouldn't see that in front of the camera. So that stuff rubs me the wrong way. I want to know that this is real. I want to feel like this is a grudge match, that they're going to, you know, beat each other up and may the best man win. But I don't want to hear about personal stuff, and I sure as hell don't want to hear about personal stuff from someone who afterwards, literally seconds afterwards, is going to be like, yo, man, that was all for show. Much love. You're great.
You say there isn't a title, Ariel, but there is a title, a contrived title, the BMF title. Is Colby Covington not bad enough to be eligible for this thing, or is that just for a glass case somewhere?
Well, technically, the BMF champion is Kamaru Usman because he beat Jorge Masvidal. I could do an hour on the BMF title. The BMF title was this clever thing, thought up by Nathan Diaz on the spot, didn't involve anyone else. He beats Anthony Pettis, and he's like, yo, I'm the champion, and now I want to defend this fictitious belt that I came up with in my mind that was, like, it was charming, it was endearing, it was so very Diaz. And then all of a sudden they, I don't know if this is a real word, but they corporatized it, right? They came out with their little press conference. They trademarked it. They ruined the whole thing. There should have never been a BMF title, an actual physical BMF title. It should have just been the Diaz title that he made up on his own, some way, somehow, and he goes out and defends it, and then it just kind of gets, like, lost in the ether. That's that. So I don't want to hear anything about no BMF title, and if there is a BMF champion out there, I guess the lineal champ is Kamaru Usman. But, like, what does it all mean? It's all very silly, in my opinion. So, yeah. Let's make a King of Miami title with palm trees and Don Johnson on it. Like, get the F out of here. What is this nonsense?
So what do you want to see coming out of this? Because Colby has already started his next round of trash talking and trying to sell the fight in his Colby way, talking about Dustin Poirier and stuff like that. This is the other thing about this being a main event of the pay-per-view is, like, neither of these guys is talking about, like, hey, this could get me back in the title mix. And maybe some of that is just realism that they both lost to Usman twice. But, like, Masvidal said all that matters to him is, you know, putting Colby in the hospital, and Colby's already starting the trash talk cycle for the next one. So to me, that's, and I know that we were supposed to get Holloway and Volk on this one, and this wasn't intended to be the 1A main event of a pay-per-view on its own, but that's where we're at, and both of these guys are, I don't know, it doesn't feel like there's stakes, and that's part of what the issue is with this type of build. Is, like, it's one thing if it's for a title or the guy's moving on to the next thing, but Colby's just ready to run the cycle back with a different person, like swapping out Jorge's name for Poirier and cutting the same promo over and over again. So where do you go with these two guys out of this?
Yeah, that's the problem. They have both lost twice to Usman. Usman is fighting Leon Edwards next, we hope, we think. If Edwards beats him, that opens everything up, right? Because now you have the Masvidal-Edwards rivalry, the three-piece Minnesota thing from 2019. That would make sense if Masvidal wins, of course. You would have to think if Edwards beats Usman, Usman's going to get an immediate rematch. But let's pretend that he doesn't. He gets injured. Then maybe Masvidal, you know, gets back in there. Same with Colby, right? Colby Edwards is a fresh matchup. I think Colby's the second best welterweight in the world right now, and you know, he deserves to be in that spot. He's an incredible fighter. There is that Hamzat Chimaev fight on April 9th against Gilbert Burns. If Hamzat wins, changes everything. He could then, you know, have a very strong case for the number one contender spot. But I agree with you as well. Like, Colby comes from the Chael Sonnen school of trash talking, and what I mean by that is the brilliance of Chael back in the day, who I love dearly, is that he was always on to the next one, right? He was planting seeds for the next one while he was dealing with the upcoming one. So you're seeing that now with Colby. He's planting seeds for the Poirier fight as he's getting ready for Masvidal. When he fought Usman, he was planting seeds for the Masvidal fight as he was getting ready for Usman back in November. I don't think he's getting the Poirier fight. I think Poirier is not a guy who, like, plays around with this stuff. Like, I think Poirier truly despises him. Like, I don't think he would even entertain the idea. Maybe I'm wrong, but they're not even on the same, you know, trajectory right now. They're not even in the same weight class, to be honest. Poirier has talked about 170, but right now he's a 55er. So, yeah, that, I agree with you. There aren't really any stakes for now. If Usman wins, excuse me, loses, it changes everything. But, yeah, that's the other thing about this fight. Like, what exactly are they fighting about? It's a grudge match. It's just a pure old-fashioned grudge match. And I think, again, 2 years ago it would have been bigger because Masvidal was younger, fresher, not coming off a knockout. But let's be honest. Let's call it like it is. I think the appeal
early on in this rivalry was, and it was the same with Woodley, we wanted to see the MAGA guy get punched in the face, right? But then we found out that Masvidal is as much of a MAGA guy as Colby. And now they're both trying to, like, fight who's better friends with Donald Trump. So you're like, well, who am I supposed to root for here? They both kind of have heelish qualities, if you get what I'm saying.
Yeah, 100%. So I want to pitch I don't even think this is a conspiracy theory, but it's something that I actually do believe, because Blake mentions, hey, where do we go from here? And, yeah, even if Usman does lose, I guess Colby has the more interesting upshot in that, yeah, I guess he could end up fighting Edwards and he could end up in a Hamzat fight. I find him to be more of like an all-around, could actually win fighter than Masvidal, who seems, you know, pretty limited and at his age and all these different things. It's I don't care who beats Kamaru. I don't think he's ever going to be champion again. But the UFC gives him this deal, right? They pay Masvidal. They give him one now. And we don't know the terms. I mean, I'm sure you do, but apparently it makes him one of the top five paid fighters in the UFC. And he says he's paid like a champion now. Did they give him this contract so that he didn't go fight a Paul brother?
Yeah, you see, look, I was going to just say, I think we got off on the wrong foot today, JD. I do like you. And it was a little bit, I thought it was a little mean-spirited, if I'm being honest on your end, some of the things you say, but I'll let you apologize.
It's okay.
You're very smart. Let me tell you something right now. Israel Adesanya, Jorge Masvidal, Nathan Diaz, and perhaps in short order, Conor McGregor, when they all get their new deals, because it's all trending in that direction, they need to thank Jake Paul, honestly, because the threat of Jake Paul is what is making the UFC sign these guys. Is he 185? I mean, is it a fair fight? No, but like him going to fight Jake would be a big deal. Masvidal going to fight Jake would be a big deal. Diaz going to fight Jake would be a big deal. Conor going, they're all in that orbit, right? And I think 100% you can make a very strong case that the threat of Jake Paul and his manager, Nikita Bedarian, who used to be the CFO of the UFC, who Dana White despises, and also the relationship with Showtime, makes the UFC say, hey, we're not going to let these guys go over there after we built them and make money with them. You know, like, it's not going to happen with them being Showtime, right? So, yes, there is 100% a case to be made there, and I think it's really fascinating because right now you could, you know, I know we can all, like, argue about pay, and there's definitely arguments to be made. The top 1%, 2%, 3% of the UFC, they're getting paid more than they've ever gotten paid before. Now, I would still strongly argue they're not getting paid what they deserve, nowhere near what the top 1%, 2% of boxing are making, but they're making big dollars now that they weren't making a few years ago. And you get to that point when there's a threat, right, when there's competition. Jake Paul, this little YouTuber guy, right, the Disney guy, single-handedly, he's not a promotion. He's not Coker and Bellator. He's not Pride. He's not nothing. He's just one dude with a funky haircut and a bunch of tattoos, and he is making them up the ante. Pretty damn amazing. And again, for everyone who doesn't want to give him credit, your favorite fighter is not getting paid because of his presence. I think he deserves some credit for that. So you're 100% right.
So you had his brother Logan on your show recently.
Yes.
You and I talked about this beforehand. Did you manage to get the angle where you're Logan Paul's plus one and mouthpiece for WrestleMania?
Logan doesn't need my help, if we're being honest. He's very good on the mic. Dare I say he's somewhat charming. I actually really enjoyed him on the show.
It was good.
Matured. I thought it was really him talking about like the mistake that he made back in 2018 and not being able to watch his old stuff, I thought was really interesting. I thought I gave him a money idea having Hezbollah come out with him. I thought that was tremendous because we've been going back and forth with him. Of course, yesterday we find out that, you know, Patrick McAfee, my longtime rival, is going to be a part of WrestleMania. It feels like I don't know. I feel like I'm like the kid on the playground. No one wants to pick me to play. I mean, like, I feel like I can run circles around all these guys when it comes to mic work. You know, maybe I can't run the ropes like them, but I feel like I can, you know, outwork them on the mic, and no one's tagging me in. Maybe I have to call my old friend Tony Khan and see if there's a place for me over there. I don't know, but I'm feeling a little bit neglected right now, if I'm being honest.
Wow. If I'm not mistaken, Ariel, Greg Hardy's on the last fight of his contract. And, you know, he could go out in the first round and knock out Sergey Spivak and earn a new deal. Or he could, you know, need a puffer again and get submitted in the third round and lose and maybe walk away from the UFC for good. I always thought, you know, when ESPN got involved, that the importance of the crossover athlete, and we've seen several crossover athletes, would be, you know, something they'd really key into. But I don't know if that's the case anymore. What do you think about the importance of crossover athletes and, you know, where Greg Hardy stands in this entire equation?
Well, I appreciate the question. A bit of a buzzkill, if I'm being honest. We're like, here we're having fun talking about wrestling. It's like Greg Hardy, womp womp. I'm good with the Greg Hardy experiment. I'm good. No, it's okay. I'm good. I'm tapping out on the Greg Hardy thing. I'm good, guys. I don't need it anymore. Please fight out your contract. We're all good. Like, there's no, we thought, all right, Uber athlete, NFL star, you're going to come over. You're going to, you know, do like somersaults over people. It hasn't quite panned out. He lost to Tai Tuivasa. He's had other kind of weird moments. Like, I don't think that this experiment worked out, if they're being honest, and I certainly don't think that the juice is worth the squeeze on this one. Do you guys remember back in January of 2019? I'm sure JD does, like maybe you do as well. First ever UFC show on ESPN, any kind of ESPN platform, the Brooklyn card, Barclays, with TJ Dillashaw, Henry Cejudo. They put Greg Hardy on that card next to Rachel Ostovich. Rachel Ostovich, just several months removed from being brutally beaten up by her at the time partner, and you put Greg Hardy, we know his history, on the same card? On the same card you have to do this? I mean, is that not the most tone-deaf thing? I still can't get over that 3 years later. He's not the athlete that we thought he was, or should I say, not the fighter that we thought he could be. And when you take a flyer on a guy like that, you take a flyer because you think, like, oh, this guy's going to be special. He's not special. Let's just be honest. He's not. Like, he's just a mid-tier heavyweight at this point, and I don't think he's getting much better. So, I don't know. Like, of course, you could see crossover guys. You could see them do the thing. But, like, in the UFC, to get to the point to where you need to be, like, a legit contender, it takes a – I mean, it's just a really hard sport. It's, dare I say, harder than boxing to make that crossover, because there's the wrestling, there's the grappling, there's all this stuff that you need to learn. So that's why, you know, you'll see heavyweights do it. You see the tough 10 guys. You know, there was Matt Mitrione who did it, and Brendan Schaub did it, these dudes. Like, it's usually the bigger boys that do it coming from football. But more often than not, they don't turn into, you know, super-duper stars. And you're seeing that once again with Greg Hardy. So, I don't know. Even if you're
right,
I don't really see much of an upside.
No one cares. Greg Hardy is relevant. And it's just, it gets back, it actually ties into the beginning part of our conversation, which is the UFC's model for building up people. They go, well, at least Greg Hardy's a name. You know, people know who his name is. Yeah, he was coming in, and the whole idea was you're taking a risk on this guy because maybe he's a super freak athlete who can tear up the sport and be a dominant presence. He's, like, not even mid. He's less. He's just a name. But they look at it, and they go, yeah, we can put him on a card as a filler, and it's a name we know, and we don't really build up the brand of any other fighter unless they make it themselves. And now the business model appears to be, instead of paying fighters what they're due in their primes or what they are due on a trajectory, it's, oh, you've made a name for yourself? Okay, we'll pay you so that you don't go fight Jake Paul and you don't go embarrass the brand at all. That's it. That's the model. That's the only way that a star is going to get paid. It's amazing. So, yes, kudos to the Paul brothers. Kudos to Jake. Kudos to you for coming on. This was great. Thanks for making time, buddy.
That's it. No more time. I was having fun.
I know. We ran out of time.
Ron McClain?
No, we have the end of the show. We have the end of the show up next is what we're doing. That's the end. That's like we go, and then we go and we finish. I'm going to go do Vancouver radio. You want to listen to me over there, you can do that. I'm joining Halford and Bro.
I didn't see the end. Did the Raptors beat the Pistons last night? I didn't catch the end of the game. I fell asleep right before.
You probably fell asleep because the Pistons or the Knicks were losing by 20 again. Have you guys have you been within 20 points in the last like 3 games? When's the last time the Knicks lost by less than 20?
Like
I thought this
like
was
I
your
said
year.
Since the beginning.
Yeah,
like you guys, I said since the beginning, should have never
the
let
the Garden's
Casey
back.
Go.
The
That's
Garden's back. Bing bong.
Casey,
oh, you're trash.
Casey should have never let him go. All right, guys. Thank you.
Good one.
Thanks,
you,
Ariel.
Man. Ariel Helwani. Host of the MMA Hour, the Ariel Helwani Show. We're back to no, we're not back tomorrow. Today's Friday.
Nope,
I thought it was Thursday for a second. Yeah. No thanks. I'm good. I'm gonna just rest up now. I'm gonna go back. I'm actually gonna do that Vancouver show. I get to play the heel there. That's always fun. You know, trash Vancouver. That's me in 10 minutes. Good week, fellas. We'll be back next one. It's the Fan Morning Show. Subscribe to the podcast. Leave a review. Thanks for listening. See you next week.